Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So this talk is titled Precepts as Path, Vow, and Koan. I just had to throw it all in there. What can I tell you? Last month, just before Rohatsu, I did a Dharma talk titled Alone Together about the intimacy that develops during Sesshin, or during a silent retreat, Sesshin, as we practice together, each of us doing our own practice. Last week, Joshin did a talk about how we practice, including with the precepts, talking both about how we practice individually as well as in relationship to others. And she went on to talk about the sense of belonging that we find here as we continue to practice. This week, I'd like to approach the practice primarily from that first aspect, how we each practice individually with the precepts, especially looking at path, as well as the vow and koan aspects of that practice. Always keeping in mind that there's no real separation from together practice and how we practice in relationship with others. So the precepts classes are in process right now, and this is a part of our annual liturgical calendar. The open Wednesday classes, evening classes in January and the first part of February focus on the precepts and how we work with them in preparation for Jukai, our annual retreat, where those who wish to commit to keeping these ethical guidelines can formally and publicly do so. Joshin and Carrie are teaching those classes this year, and this year, as Shinyu mentioned earlier, we will be doing Dai Jukai, which includes all five ceremonies handed down to us from Jiyu Kennet, going back to Keizon. Joshin is organizing the classes this year around those five ceremonies. Well, it brings up these questions about what does it mean to make a commitment to these precepts? What does it mean to keep the precepts? What happens if I mess up? So let's back up just a moment and point out that from the beginning of Buddhism, it has been clear that without ethical guidelines, our practice is dangerously flawed, with many pitfalls and traps along the way. In fact, ethical guidelines are embedded in the Four Noble Truths as a large part of the Eightfold Path outlined by the Buddha in the Fourth Noble Truth to reduce suffering in the world. These eight are right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So a couple of things to note here. The word right isn't so much about a black and white concept of good and bad. It's more about what's effective, what's true, what constitutes our very best effort, what's aligned with our highest Buddha nature. The second thing to note is that they are all interconnected. Each supports the rest. And the same is true of the precepts as we study and practice them now. The third thing is that the precepts are right in the middle of this list, showing up as right speech, which is our fourth great precept, along with the sixth and seventh, and right action, which is the first three grave precepts specifically, and others, of course, implicitly. Right intention refers to vow, which I will return to in a few minutes. So here's one way of describing right speech, and this is from a Theravadin approach, which I have turned into a handout that I use extensively in teaching the Eightfold Path. Right speech is the first principle of ethical conduct in the Eightfold Path. Ethical conduct is viewed as a guideline to moral discipline, which supports the other principles of the path. This aspect is not self-sufficient. However, it is essential because moral purification can only be achieved through the cultivation of ethical conduct. The importance of speech in the context of Buddhist ethics is obvious. Words can break or save lives, make enemies or friends, start war or create peace. Buddha explained right speech as follows. 1. To abstain from false speech, especially not to tell deliberate lies and not to speak deceitfully. 2. To abstain from slanderous speech and not to use words maliciously against others. 3, to abstain from harsh words that offend or hurt others. And 4, to abstain from idle chatter that lacks purpose or depth. So positively phrased, this means to tell the truth, to speak in a friendly, warm, and gentle manner, and to talk only when necessary. That last is a big one. You might think that the Eightfold Path would be all we would need to keep going in the right direction, because it's pretty comprehensive. But of course, the human mind is infinitely devious and inventive, and many specific kinds of misconduct showed up in the early practice, which prompted the making of more specific rules. These proliferated into the Vinaya, which had hundreds of rules, some of which are now considered obsolete as conditions have changed. The 16 Bodhisattva precepts that we now use have broadened back out to more basic guidelines, still quite in line with the original Eightfold Path. Here's what Robert Aitken in The Mind of Clover says about the problems of practice without ethical guidelines. Without the precepts as guidelines, Zen Buddhism tends to become a hobby, made to fit the needs of the ego. Selflessness, as taught in Zen centers, conflicts with the indulgence that is encouraged by society. The student is drawn back and forth from outside to within the Zen center, tending to use the center as a sanctuary from the difficulties experienced in the world. In my view, the true Zen Buddhist center is not just sanctuary, but a source from which ethically motivated people move outward to engage in the larger community. So there again, we have individual practice and practice in relationship. So many other sources down through the years emphasize that practice must be grounded in the precepts in order to keep us on the path toward the Buddha. Here at Dharma Rain, our lineage emphasizes two aspects of practice: meditation or zazen on the one hand, and work with precepts on the other, sometimes called karmic relationships. Our primary introductory workshops reflect this, the first being an introduction to Zen meditation, and the second being about starting a Buddhist practice, which includes an introduction to the precepts, as well as some basics about how to move around in the Zendo, what a service is like, and that sort of thing. Part of my interest in doing this talk comes from a recent starting a practice workshop that I assisted leading with Hakugyu. It was a lot of fun, a lot of thoughtful questions raised. And the other is that we recently completed a course of study on the precepts in one of my prison groups, culminating in giving the precepts to 5 women a few weeks ago. As a result of these two experiences, I've been talking with several people recently who are learning about this practice and grappling with how it works and how to make it their own. This talk will definitely not answer all questions on the subject, but will hopefully give a few ideas and maybe raise some more questions to bring to the Wednesday night class. Now let's talk about vow. We say that we commit to keep the precepts. What does this mean? So I went back to my handout to talk about right intention, and here's what it says. While right view refers to the cognitive aspect of wisdom, which is right view was the first on the Noble Eightfold Path, right intention, which is the second one, refers to the volitional aspect, that is, the kind of mental energy that controls our actions. Right intention can be described best as commitment to ethical and mental self-improvement. Buddha distinguishes 3 types of right intention. 1, the intention of renunciation, which means resistance to the pull of desire. 2, the intention of goodwill, meaning resistance to feelings of anger and aversion. And 3, the intention of harmlessness, meaning not to think or act cruelly, violently, or aggressively, and to develop compassion. So, interestingly enough, these all have to do with the mind. It says the mental activity, the mental energy, what's going on in terms of your thoughts, not just your actions. The ethical conduct part gets more into actions, but you have to precede it with some right understanding and a right intention or vow or aspiration. Shohaku Okamura, in his book Living by Vow, contrasts living by karma with living by vow. And here's what he says. Karma means habit, preferences, or a ready-made system of values. It's kind of what we're born with. As we grow up, we learn a system of values from the culture around us, which we use to evaluate the world and choose actions. This is karma and living by karma. In contrast, a bodhisattva lives by vow. Vow is like a magnet or compass that shows the direction toward the Buddha. So we have to be aware of what we're doing and what we're living by, and we have to choose to make a change if we're going to do that. And sometimes we use different words for vow, like intention, aspiration, or commitment, and all of these words work. Sometimes the word vow can carry emotional baggage that can get in the way. So feel free to substitute one of these words if you wish as I continue this discussion. One of our regular practices is to take term vows, vows that we express to look at a particular behavior for a limited time, often 2 or 3 months. This is usually enough time to make it clear how far off the mark we are in following the aspiration we've committed to. But really, there's not a lot of point in making a vow to do something you're already doing perfectly. The point is that there is something we want to change in our life, something we may feel we lack, or that we do poorly, or that has consistently bad outcomes. I suggest to people that they look deeply into their own hearts to see who they really want to be and what may be getting in the way of that. I don't think of it so much as a self-improvement process as a step towards self-discovery and realization. The process of putting this understanding forward in a formal and public way is a powerful tool for turning our attention to this particular aspect of our lives. So in the word public, here again points to the relational aspect of an individual vow. So we don't do it in isolation. I mean, we can, but it's much more powerful and potent if we do it in public, in relationship. We each have to do the work ourselves. And yet, the fact that it is seen by others, affects others, and is affected by others makes a difference. So, okay, you have decided on a vow and stated it publicly. Now what happens? The first thing that often happens is that resistance arises. Wait a minute, who says I have to do this? Or, conversely, there's no way I can do this, so why even try? Or possibly other forms of resistance. And, of course, no one can make you keep a vow or even pay any attention to it. I will have to confess there have been times during a term that I have forgotten what my vow was. So, and you know what? Nobody noticed. Except me. It's also true that you will mess it up. So just let go of that worry right now. It's guaranteed. After all, as I pointed out, if you already had it down, there would be no point in making a vow. Depending on your own karmic patterns, your resistance might take one of these forms or perhaps another one altogether. But really, what we are doing in this practice is turning our attention to a particular aspect of our lives. That includes looking at our resistance and our own reaction to having taken a stand on whatever it is. Regardless of how we succeed or fail in our attempt to change some aspect of our behavior, we learn something about ourselves in the process, and that is a success. Sometimes a vow can change during a term. I had a prison sangha member some years back who took a vow to look at the second precept, do not steal, to see what was causing her to do this. About halfway through the term, she reported that she had discovered fear underneath the impulse to steal and committed herself to investigating that. I saw this as a spectacular success in that she was able to face her own karmic conditioning squarely and learn something about herself eventually letting go of it. My own experience is that by the end of the term, I am more clear than ever about how I fail to keep the vow I have made, and also now that it's time to set down the vow, realize that I have incorporated it somehow into my way of being and acting with some sense of how to move forward with it. So oftentimes, failure in this sense is really success. So this leads me to another aspect of this practice, which is koan. I'm not an expert on koan practice and study, but I can maybe offer a few ideas and hints in this direction. So first, a koan is sometimes described as an unanswerable question. And this isn't quite right. It's more like a question that can't be answered with logic, using mental faculties. Some people say it can't be answered in words, which makes sense because words get down to language, which is mental, using mental faculties, and it's sorting and all of that sort of stuff. There are several collections of koans in Buddhist literature, and a lot of them seem to be stories that don't seem to make a lot of sense on the face of them. And many sects of Zen have a curriculum of koans that students have to demonstrate their understanding of in order to move forward with their practice with a teacher. So again, in relationship. Here at Dharma Rain, we don't have a formal curriculum, but we work with koans that show up in our own personal lives. If you think about it for a moment, you can probably think of one or more situations in your own life that don't yield to logical problem solving. For me, some of these were how questions and how do I know questions. But these have to work on us as we sit still and let an answer or understanding arise. Our work with precepts is often like this. When we say we are keeping the precepts, we mean that we sit with the koans that they present in a way that allows them to suggest a way forward. We allow ourselves to be affected by them. Kyogen gave a talk several years ago titled Precepts as Path and speaks about how we can see precepts as practice as koan work. And here's what he says. In the Zen tradition, we also emphasize the koan aspect of practice. Any close examination of them reveals how they cannot be kept perfectly. We're always killing, of course. All eating is killing, and our immune systems are always at work. In some traditions, the line is clearly drawn at not killing another human being. Although I've heard some people say, well, in a war it's okay, or in self-defense it's okay, so there, you know, there get to be all kinds of ways to say, eh, maybe not. But for us, it's not so simple. Some people think that without a clear line, we will permit anything. But in fact, it means that we refine our understanding. We work to minimize the harm we do in many dimensions. And looking at it this way, the koan aspect of the precept arises. The second precept is sometimes worded, do not take what is not given, which is quite a bit more subtle than do not steal and gets to the heart of the matter. Understanding what is given and what is not becomes much more subtle. As the line gets fuzzy, what is the real meaning of the precept? That's where it gets interesting. Yet another way the precepts turn into koans is when we have to break the letter of one precept in order to keep the real spirit of another. So I mentioned that in the past, one of my persistent how questions was, how does this process work? I now get this question from other people. What are the steps to follow? What do I need to do, read, understand? I remember to please, eager to do the right thing, if only someone would just explain what to do. And mostly I didn't get a very satisfying answer. I suspect some of you can relate to that experience. The answer I best recall is one I got from Kyogen, who said, just keep doing what you're doing. Not altogether satisfying, but at the time I was newly in residence, sitting zazen regularly, participating in community life, doing what I was told, and so on. So, okay, I trusted Kyogen. And he demonstrated his trust in the practice, especially the practice of Zazen. Over and over, I saw his deep faith in the practice, and I have now verified it for myself and feel that same faith and trust. I wish I could be more helpful, but really, I haven't found any better answer to this how question than just do the practice. Certainly involves Zazen, which gives us a very specific practice in stopping, the first pure precept. It also gives us practice in stepping back and noticing what's going on, mindfulness of both body and mind. What's happening now, right now, in this moment? This practice bears fruit whenever we encounter other aspects of our lives, at home, at work, in relationships with others. So here's Kyogen again. When we stay still, we can take the next step. This is to take an action that is not conditioned by the old karma. The first part, being still, is the first pure precept, cease from evil, release all self-attachment. The next step is, do only good, take selfless action. That action is one moment of liberation. It would be wonderful if that was sufficient to overcome the karma and habit energy we have accumulated. Unfortunately, it practically never is. It's just one moment. And habit energy must be undone bit by bit, over and over. Nonetheless, this moment has tremendous power. Once we see that we can slip the bonds of old habits, the days of bondage are numbered. He goes on to say, we have a way of understanding the arc of Zen practice, of refining our relationship to the precepts. Describing it briefly, the path begins with the recognition of dukkha, suffering, dissatisfaction, which means to say that the precept is with ourselves, not with the way the world is. We see that we need to change the way we go about things, and this is the essence of contrition, the first element in the Kyoji Kaimon, the booklet about the precepts. Next, when we trust our intuition that there is something to seek, something to awaken to, we have the first appearance of taking refuge in our own deeper nature, our own Buddha mind. When we follow this intuition and seek a path and a teaching about a path, we are taking refuge in Dharma, no matter what the path is that we end up taking. When we choose a teacher or community and make a commitment, we are taking refuge in Sangha. These are the three treasures, the three refuges, in an elemental form. Next, applying the teachings and making some changes in our lives is the first application of the three pure precepts. Someone might stop partying or drinking or break off a toxic relationship. These are all ceasing from evil. But then this requires seeking something better, a more healthy way to live. So coming to a Zen center might be part of that. This is doing good. And as we do this, the third pure precept of doing good for others arises. This means that we allow ourselves to be engaged in life. We let it affect us and practice with it in the same way we practice with our own thoughts and feelings. Our practice embraces everything. And so, even though in this talk I have come to the practice with precepts primarily from the direction of individual practice, I circle back around to the relational aspect of practice. We do both. We practice alone, together. We are informed both by our individual practice and our relationships with others. None of this happens quickly. We can go for quite a while thinking that nothing is happening. But at some point, we look back and realize something profound has shifted. And we can't usually explain any better than I did exactly how it happened, when it happened, what steps we followed, or even precisely what has changed. So as we continue to study and work with the precepts, I encourage you to be patient and gentle with yourself, to bring humor and curiosity to the process, as well as determination and persistence. It's a lifelong path, and there is always more to uncover and more ways to grow. So that's my talk for the day, and I'm open to questions and comments.
Thank you, Genko. One thing I've been noticing lately in my practice and relationship with the precepts is the presence of fear in that moment of noticing and then realizing that if I want something to shift in my relationship, for example, that there will be some change and it'll be uncomfortable and mm-hmm. There's uncertainty about how that will unfold because I can't control the process or the other person.
Yes.
And I think I've gotten to a point where I can see that it's about having relationship with that fear and knowing it's not 100% going to go away. Mm-hmm. It's not something you resolve, per se. But I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit more to kind of what that can look like or what can be helpful in that moment of noticing, like, I want to make this change or I want to notice where it's coming from, but there's also fear about what I might discover in that moment.
Yeah, that's pretty common. So there is this, one of the three marks is impermanence. Mm-hmm. And I think we have kind of both of those feelings, like I want things to stay the way they are, mm-hmm. and I want things to change. So we have both of those impulses going mm-hmm. on. And to the extent that we try to keep things the way they are, we're increasing our own suffering, and perhaps the suffering of others as well. The fear, though, is really there. It's really valid because we're not in control. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of uncertainty about it. And we don't know which way it's going to go. We don't even know how we're doing what we're doing, right? And that is kind of how this stuff goes. And mm-hmm. it's unnerving. All I can say is it gets a little easier with practice. Mm-hmm. So you're finding some ways to relate to it, which is good. Mm-hmm. And I think you'll find, I don't know that it ever gets completely comfortable, but you get yeah. used to it,
yeah.
you know?
And there's something about having been here this past year and practicing, sitting uh-huh. on the cushion with other people, just knowing, like,
right.
okay, here are all these other people who are, like, dealing with their own stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah, there are some moments when sitting at home feels almost intolerable.
Right.
And I hear some giggles. I'm glad I'm not the only one. But I guess it's ongoing. Thank you. I appreciate that.
And as you point out, part of the part of how we work with it is with Sangha. So being able to hear other people talk about what they're doing is helpful. Also, being able to talk about it yourself helps to lighten the burden a bit because it's now shared. So that's a very helpful thing.
Lena, I guess I would just add on to what Lena said. It reminded me of, not to bring Harry Potter into the Zendo, but I'm doing it. There's an incident where he walks into this spell where his whole world is turned upside down, and it feels terrifying. Like the most terrifying thing would be to take a step forward, but that's paradoxically the antidote to the spell. And so when he takes that spell forward, the world rights itself, and he can move forward. And I always find it vexing and comforting that the remedy to that kind of discomfort or fear or terror is actually to turn toward it, which always feels like the last thing I want to do. And I imagine others experience that as well.
Yeah. Thank you. Over here.
Genko, thank you for your talk. How do you know which of the 16 precepts to work on? I mean, I have a very analytical mind, and I'm going like, well, gosh, which one am I going to work on, or am I going to wait to be angry, or, you know, how does that work?
The way it was explained to me the very first time I ever heard these precepts was pretty funny, actually. We kind of went through them, and I thought, oh, I got all that. Ooh, I don't know what to say about that, other than... but one of the things that the workshop leader pointed out was... So we have this practice, which I did not go into, this Kyoju Kaimon practice, to do with reading it in the morning, just sort of going through it. And out loud is really best if you can manage that. Here we're chanting it every morning as part of our morning practice. And then in the evening, kind of going through and drawing the events of the day through the mind and noticing any moment of contraction, or the sensation of contraction, or a kind of a, lots of times there's a little bit of a ew or a something. I mean, that can give you a clue, but again, it's not a matter of looking at that and analyzing, well, what I should have done was. It's more a matter of just sort of noticing it and then letting that go. Next morning, when you read the precepts again, it may be that one of them jumps out at you. Or at least there's something you can... I think you start getting to a place where you start noticing the feel of it. So it isn't so particularly analytical. It really is more of a matter of, oh, there's something there. And that's the best way to choose, if you're choosing. And yes, certainly notice when you get angry at somebody and say, oh, there's a precept about that. But mostly it's a little bit less mental than that. And yeah, I think a lot of us kind of have that kind of analytical mind, and we want to figure it all out, and we'll use the mind, certainly, but really at some point what we're doing is cultivating I don't know any better way to say it than just sort of the feel of it. It's not quite the same as an emotion. It's more, there's a different kind of knowing, maybe is the better way to say it.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of tools here, too, that
right.
that provide that, what you're talking about. So
yes.
Thank you.
Yes. It's like a rule that, you know, you have to have a question from this side of the room and then a question on that side of the room to make people, you know, walk back and forth a lot.
Thank you for your talk. I have one of the things that resonated with me was that when you talked to, I think you were quoting Roshi Aiken, where we come to the Zendo, it's kind of easier to hold the precepts, and then we go out into the world and it's much more difficult. That's definitely been my experience. It feels lighter to hold the precepts here, but then I go to work and I'm like, I really want to talk shit about my coworkers right now, and I want to complain about this or that, and I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Well, I don't think he was trying to say it's easier. I think he was trying to say that's what we're going for, is to take them out into the world with us, where, in fact, it is much more difficult. One of the things I have been sort of bemused by is that a lot of times people in prison will say, when I get out, things will be easier. It'll be easier for me to practice. It'll be easier for me to do zazen. It'll be easier for me to work with the precepts. And I'm like, no, it won't. It's a lot harder then, actually, because there's so many more things going on. And I think it's, you know, we kind of all do that. It's like, well, if my life were only different, right? So, it gets messy out there. It gets messy. So we can have these precepts, and so, you know, in my own mind, I had it all down. It was fine. But I was not, at that point, I was just plain not aware of all of the ways that things were going not so well. And so part of the recollection process in particular is to help us begin to identify where we're going where we're going wrong, where things are not working for us. And after a while, you start seeing patterns and saying, oh, this is kind of about that precept, or this is kind of, you know, this is something that I do that is kind of like that. And that allows you then to focus on it, and that gets you into that, you know, you see, you have the understanding, and then that gets you to a place where you can make an intention or a vow around it. And the vow might just be to look at it and see if you can find a way to work with it. Sometimes you put an intention out there and you don't have any idea, I mean, how it's going to work or what that even means, or but you just sort of put it there and kind of hold it and see what happens.
Yeah. Thank you.
And Daicho.
Thank you for your talk. I was wondering that sometimes precepts feel like almost like kind of up there in the cloud in some way, because life experience oftentimes involves you're in pain. Mm-hmm. And precepts do not directly talk about pain. Mm. Seems like it's so to me that connection. I can see that out of pain I might get angry, or I might, you know, slander somebody, or I might kill some, you know, something. And, but
there's a little pain involved with that, I would think.
There's pain involved, but yeah. The precepts themselves don't really talk about it. And how is that so? Because, you know, oftentimes in our daily life, the most oftentimes the significant thing is like some kind of pain that we have.
Mm. I think the way I have always liked to think about the precepts is that they are a description of a life lived in harmony with your best, your highest Buddha nature in a natural way. And so they're somewhat idealized. So I think you have something there, that's, there is a way that they, you know, there's a brilliant sea of clouds, you know, and, yeah. You know, the sweet dew covers the earth and within it lies the truth. I mean, all of those are beautiful phrases and there's a lot of truth to them. And I guess I think of them as images and phrases to hold on to as ways of reminding us that direction that we're trying to get to, a direction we're going. And the 10 grave precepts are very specific about the kinds of things they don't want you to do, right? Mm-hmm. And that's very helpful because implied in all of those is if you do this, you're gonna have karma, which is painful. So it's not explicitly talking about it, but it is definitely in there. And I believe, I mean, I feel like that the point of it is to try to reduce that. It's just not dwelling on that. It's dwelling more on, but here's where you want to be going.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
I've been back here Googling Katagiri quotes to find this one quote, but I can't find it. And it's something like, your spiritual progress is not your business.
It's
Have you heard
what?
That quote?
Your business.
Have uh-huh. you heard that quote by Katagiri? It's the whole progress or not progress, pushing hard or not pushing hard, effort, no effort, task-oriented versus just kind of letting it flow. And I grappled with that for a long time, and Kyogen would try to talk me through it, and it never really worked. And then I found this amazing Katagiri quote, and he basically says, it's not your business. In uh-huh. other words, just uh-huh. do it.
To sort of like keep track and like, you know, check the boxes. I remember you talking about checking the boxes.
Absolutely,
and making
yeah.
sure that you're doing everything the way you're supposed to do it, all that stuff, yeah.
Yep, 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 yeah. Because, and yeah. It was an amazing quote, and it just kind of was, it kind of helped me break through in a way I couldn't before. And somebody else described it as, you know, just let the bread bake, as opposed to kind of opening the door and peering in all the time, double checking. And just let it bake.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's really hard for me, but I keep coming back to that.
That's a good way to think of it, is letting the bread bake. And that's the way a lot of it is. So, and one of the things that I really see working with a lot of different people, I just find people so interesting. Everybody does this differently, you know? And what I see is that everybody is making progress, if you want to call it that. They're moving forward. They're moving forward with their lives. And sometimes I can look at it and say, I don't get what that person's doing at all. Or, I don't think that's going to work so well. And it doesn't matter. That's not the point. The point is, everybody is just moving forward, and we're all doing the best we can. I mean, that is the reality. And sometimes you just have to kind of back off and let the bread bake and wait to see, you know, wait for the timer to go off and see what happens. You find out, I think, the time I was thinking about the timer going off. You find out in times of life and death issues that are going on, that's when you really see it. You know, so all of a sudden it's kind of like, wow, I really do know what I'm doing. I really do know how to be with this moment. I really do. I really can do this in a way that you realize you wouldn't have been able to do before you did a lot of this practice. So and that's what I meant at the end, where I said, you know, you can go on and not think and think that nothing is happening. But in fact, things are happening underneath the surface. And I am hearing noises, which lets me know that we're going to be invaded shortly with our other Sangha, and we'll get to do our closing here.